Jackson's expected to appear on stage at the Democratic National Convention tonight. He ran twice for president, in 1984 and 1988. Democracy Now! Is broadcasting 2 hours each day from the Chicago Convention as we cover the DNC from the inside out. In our other hour today, we'll be talking with Osama Siblani, who runs a newspaper in Dearborn. We'll talk about the uncommitted movement. We'll also be talking about two men who were imprisoned for over 40 years and then exonerated. What that means. That does it for our show from Chicago, from CAN TV. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will take place on Saturday, September 21st at 1 p.m. at the Show Bar in Southeast Portland. The meeting will include a State of the Station presented by KBOO's Board of Directors, as well as opportunities for members to meet the candidates running in the board election. Final votes will be cast and the results of the election will be announced at the end of the meeting. Again, that's KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election on Saturday, September 21st at 1 p.m. at the Show Bar, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. Ballots and more information can be found at kboo.fm/board24.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. National Convention in Chicago. This is Democracy Now!, War, Peace, and the Presidency. We're breaking with convention.
As president, I will be laser focused on creating opportunities for the middle class that advance their economic security, stability, and dignity. Together, we will build what I call an opportunity economy.
The Democratic National Convention opens today in Chicago. On Thursday, Kamala Harris will formally accept the Democratic presidential nomination. We'll go to the streets of Chicago, where the first protest against the DNC took place on Sunday.
Genocide always starts with the decision that some bodies need to be controlled, contained, or exterminated. And that's exactly what reproductive justice is about. And that's exactly what freeing Palestine is about ending the state's right to do that to any population.
And we will speak to two Chicago men who spent decades in prison before being exonerated.
My name is Jimmy Soto, and I'm the longest serving exoneree in the state of Illinois. It's not the fact that I served 42 years, 2 months, and 2 days. It's the conditions in which I was incarcerated. And I think everyone in America should know these deplorable conditions and how they affected me in my time in there.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of delegates and elected officials have descended on Chicago as the Democratic National Convention kicks off today. The four-day convention comes 1 month after President Biden ended his bid for re-election. Vice President Kamala Harris secured the Democratic presidential nomination in a virtual roll call earlier this month and is expected to formally accept the party's nomination when she addresses the convention Thursday. Dozens of delegates with the Uncommitted Movement are also in Chicago as they continue to pressure Harris to halt U.S. military support for Israel's war on Gaza. The delegates represent states where some 700,000 people cast uncommitted votes during primaries to protest Democrats' pro-Israel policies. Among them is the battleground state of Michigan. On Sunday, hundreds of protesters took to the streets of Chicago saying they'll disrupt the DNC until Democrats listen to their demands. We'll hear some of their voices after headlines. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's in Israel, where he warned ongoing ceasefire talks may be the last chance to free Hamas hostages, as he spoke from Tel Aviv earlier today. Blinken added, quote, "It's also time to make sure that no one takes any steps that could derail the process," unquote. On Sunday evening, an explosion on a truck in Tel Aviv killed one person believed to be the bomb's detonator. Hamas and the Islamic Jihad claimed responsibility for the blast. In Gaza, Israel's slaughter continues. The Israeli military is pushing further into central Deir al-Balah, as Gazans are now being crowded into just 10% of the besieged territory. On Saturday, an Israeli airstrike in Deir al-Balah killed at least 18 members of the same family, including 11 siblings aged between 2 and 22. On Sunday, another attack in the same region killed more Palestinian children. Mohammed Awad Khattab said six of his grandchildren were killed as they slept, along with their mother, his daughter, who worked for the United Nations.
My daughter had been struggling to have children for years. She had them through IVF. Four of the children were quadruplets. The eldest son and the youngest daughter, who was only a year and a half old, were also killed. What wrong did these innocent children do? Were they posing any danger to Israel? Were they carrying arms?
UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, is marking World Humanitarian Day today by honoring its 207 staff members killed by Israel since October 7th. A 10-month-old baby has been confirmed as Gaza's first known case of polio in a quarter of a century. The UN's called for a pause of Israel's attacks to allow aid workers to carry out a vaccination campaign against the highly contagious disease. Overwhelmed parents express fear over yet another threat to their families' lives.
We're tired of this life we are living. No food, no drink, no medicines. What are we supposed to do in this life? At the least, we need medicines for our children to protect them from being infected with the polio virus that's now spreading across Gaza. You must find a solution to our situation. We need vaccines. We need medicine. We need proper sanitation. We want you to save us before it's too late. Or how long are we supposed to wait? Should we wait until we watch our children die and become paralyzed and then become helpless to do anything for them?
On Sunday, protesters took to the streets of dozens of cities across the United States on the eve of the Democratic National Convention to demand not another bomb on Gaza. Demonstrations also took place in cities across the globe, including in Amsterdam, where massive crowds rallied to condemn the Dutch government over its failure to hold Israel accountable.
Since October, I've been going to all the demonstrations with my kids because that's all we can do. I can't believe what I'm seeing with my eyes, and I hope this, inshallah, will end soon because it's just not normal, man. Almost a year, we've been watching blown up children, blown up mothers, fathers. I don't have words. It breaks me. It breaks us all. This just has to stop now.
In Colombia, President Gustavo Petro has banned coal exports to Israel. Explaining his move, Petro posted on X, quote, "Colombian coal is used to make bombs to kill Palestinian children," unquote. Colombia had been the largest supplier of coal to Israel. As Ukrainian forces expand their incursion inside Russia, Moscow says Kyiv has struck a third bridge in the Kursk region. Russia also said its troops had captured a group of at least 19 Ukrainian soldiers in the region. Meanwhile, Belarusian President's staunch Putin ally Alexander Lukashenko has threatened Ukraine with military action as he accused Kyiv of deploying 120,000 troops along Ukraine's border with Belarus. In the Dominican Republic, President Luis Abinader has been sworn in for a second term, vowing economic reforms and to carry on a ban on asylum seekers from neighboring Haiti. His government has increased raids and deportations of Haitians and also begun construction of a 100-mile concrete wall along the border with Haiti, which is experiencing a worsening humanitarian crisis. Haitian leaders skipped his inauguration Friday. Abinader spoke from the capital, Santo Domingo.
We know the problems of Haiti need to be solved there through dialogue and the participation of the whole society. With the same strength with which we demanded the intervention of the international community in Haiti, we ask that Haiti is not forgotten again. You can't ask more of the Dominican Republic because we have already done enough.
The social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter, announced over the weekend it'll be shutting down its operations in Brazil. The move by the owner, Elon Musk, comes after X faced legal challenges in Brazil over its refusal to fight the spread of misinformation online. Earlier this year, a Brazilian judge ordered X to block certain accounts accused of spreading fake news and hate messages, including some belonging to supporters of far-right former President Jair Bolsonaro. In Bangladesh, interim leader Mohamed Yunus vowed to support the more than 1 million Rohingya refugees living in Bangladesh as he gave his first major policy address. Yunus, who's been charged with leading Bangladesh's transition after the ouster of Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, said, quote, "We need the sustained efforts of the international community for Rohingya humanitarian operations and their eventual repatriation to their homeland, Myanmar, with safety, dignity, and full rights," he said. Rohingya refugees continue to face persecution in and deadly attacks as they make the treacherous journey to Bangladesh.
The Arakan army raided our village and killed many people. Some 60 people in my village were killed. Some people took refuge under the water in the canal nearby. Some of them died as well. We couldn't count the bodies. A trafficker asked for money to ferry us to Bangladesh. I assured him that my brother-in-law lives abroad and will make the transfer, so he took us on board his boat. Many of us embarked the boat. The Myanmar army fired when we were in the middle of the sea. Around 45 people died. Some were wounded and passed away later. I'll do whatever it takes to keep my family alive. I don't have a penny left.
And the U.S. Supreme Court denied an emergency request from the Biden administration to allow its expanded Title IX rules to take effect. Earlier this year, the Biden administration updated the federal policy protecting against sex-based discrimination in schools to include LGBTQ plus and transgender students, as well as pregnant people and survivors of sexual assault. The expanded civil rights policy was supposed to take effect August 1st before Republican-led states moved to block it. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. When we come back, we hear some of the voices from the first protests in the streets of Chicago for the DNC. Stay with us.
Your dreams are not your dreams. They're only visions of what be. But I still love you. It's been a lonely year. Everyone left, but I'm still right here. I won't desert you.
Is Dangerous by Hooray for the Riff Raff. This is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from the studios of CAN TV here in Chicago. We're breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Again, we're broadcasting together in the same room for the first time in 4.5 years after the pandemic, and then Juan moved here to Chicago. It's great to be with you, Juan.
Great to be with you, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. The Democratic National Convention opens today here in Chicago, where Vice President Kamala Harris will be accepting the Democratic nomination on Thursday. While the delegates gather in the United Center for the convention, thousands of protesters are converging on Chicago to make their voices heard. Over the course of the week, there are at least 6 major protests planned. The demonstrations kicked off on Sunday on the eve of the convention with the March for Bodies Outside Unjust Laws, which was organized by a coalition of several different activist groups to demand action on reproductive rights, LGBTQ rights, and on the end to the war on Gaza.
Democracy Now! Is on the streets to cover the demonstration. These are some of the voices of the protesters.
My name is Jax Blackmore, and I am the organizing director of Shout Your Abortion. You cannot talk about reproductive justice without talking about Palestinian liberation. We are talking about body autonomy. We are talking about the freedom to control what happens to our bodies, our families, our futures, our ability to move between places. This is not something that's exclusively granted just to the American voter. This is something that we protect and stand in solidarity with people around the world and around the globe. And so we stand just as much about bodily autonomy and reproductive justice as we do for people here, as we do in Palestine.
My name is Iman Abdelhadi. I'm an organizer here in Chicago. I'm also a professor at the University of Chicago.
What specifically about queer and trans movements and reproductive rights connects to Israel's war on Gaza and the horrors that people are experiencing in Gaza today?
The genocide has had massive amounts of sexual violence and has had a disproportionate impact on women and their access to health care. But more broadly, genocide always starts with the decision that some bodies need to be controlled, contained, or exterminated. And that's exactly what reproductive justice is about. And that's exactly what freeing Palestine is about. It's about ending the state's right to do that to any population.
I'm Shama Sawant. I was a socialist on the Seattle City Council for a decade. You can see that we have 2 parties for the warmongering billionaire class. Harris and Trump are both warmongering candidates, and despite some of the differences between them, at the end of the day, it is the Biden-Harris administration that has presided over the support for this war. After Harris became the anointed, crowned candidate for the Democratic Party, after that happened, you saw the Biden-Harris administration approving more than $20 billion more for military aid to Israel.
I'm Jane Steinfels Hussein. I'm here with Code Pink, and I'm here from the Nashville Peace and Justice Center in Nashville, Tennessee.
And you were here in Chicago in 1968 for the DNC that took place that year.
It was accurately described as a police riot, and I was a witness to it. I was a street medic. I was newly graduated from the University of Chicago and hugely pregnant. And I was stuck at one point right out in front of the Hilton Hotel, where the police were beating people and dragging them and putting them in paddy wagons. And the young man who was staying with us, I spent several days afterwards looking for him at hospitals and police stations. And he was left in an alley behind the Hilton by the police after both of his legs were broken. So it was really, really violent. I think it is a pivotal moment, but there have been so many pivotal moments for the Democratic Party to take the right action, and so I don't have an awful lot of hope for the Democratic Party, but I do have a hope for the people of America, because I think young people in much greater numbers are really clued into American imperialism and the whole war economy.
Grant Rosen, the rabbi of the congregation Tzedek Chicago.
And what do you say to people who are calling for, you know, arms embargo, calling for these simple demands of ceasefire, who are pro-Palestinian, as being anti-Semitic?
It's just astonishing to hear people say stop war is somehow anti-Semitic. I mean, on a very basic level, as a rabbi, my spiritual tradition is demands that we pursue peace and we pursue justice. You know, the claim that it's somehow anti-Semitic is just, it's absurd on its face, and it shows the desperation of those who stand with Israel unconditionally. It shows the patent immorality of that position.
Justine Medina. I'm on the organizing committee at JFK 8 with ALUIBT.
Well, what brings you here today at the DNC?
The Palestinian trade unions, since this genocidal war started, have been asking for support from their labor and brother sisters around the world. So as internationalists, as fighters for labor power, we cannot, you know, ignore that call. And we are going to come here and we're going to tell everyone, Republican, Democrat, Independent, it doesn't matter. We need a ceasefire now. We need an arms embargo now. We need a liberated Palestine. You know, we need to end the occupation because the working class is global.
The possibility of Trump 2.0 is only a reality because of the many betrayals by the Biden-Harris administration. Biden and Harris, both as president and as vice president, and the Democratic Party as a whole, they broke their promise for a $15 an hour minimum wage. They blocked the railroad worker strike, which is possibly one of the most anti-worker, anti-union actions that can be taken by politicians. And so, in other words, both the Democratic and Republican parties are anti-worker, and they are both pro-war.
I want people to know that there is a strong movement within the Democratic Party, certainly with the uncommitted movement, but not only, inside the halls of the convention and out here in the streets, that there is a strong, strong constituency that is demanding a fair and humane and a just foreign policy, and in particular, an end to this genocide. And, you know, people often say that, well, this is just focusing on one issue. In a time of genocide, genocide is the only issue.
If the Democrats want us to get out the vote for them, they need to actually earn our votes by giving us a meaningful change on Gaza. They have not done that. We are not going to do the work for them of getting Kamala Harris elected if they cannot stop the most basic thing, which is the slaughter of our people abroad with our money. So for Palestinian Americans, this is a fundamental issue. And we have spent 10 months watching our people die every day. To ask us to simply come out and just wait and hope that some change will happen before the election, it's just offensive, and it's completely insensitive to where we are as a community.
Some of the voices from the first protests leading up to the Democratic National Convention here in Chicago beginning today, that protest yesterday. Special thanks to Democracy Now! Producer Sam Malkoff, Messiah Rhodes, and Maria Terracena. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, in addition to the protests on the streets, dozens of delegates with the uncommitted movement are also in Chicago as they continue to pressure Kamala Harris to halt U.S. military support for Israel's war on Gaza. The delegates represent states where some 700,000 people cast uncommitted votes during primary elections to protest the Democrats' pro-Israel policies. For the first time ever, the DNC is hosting a panel on Palestinian human rights. The uncommitted delegation delegates welcomed the move and are continuing to request that Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan, who has volunteered in Gaza, be permitted to address the convention from the stage.
Top Democrats have spent weeks meeting with uncommitted voters and their allies, including a sit-down between Harris and the mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, Abdullah Hamoud. In an effort to respond to criticism in key swing states like Michigan, which has a significant Arab American population, Harris's campaign manager, Julie Chavez Rodriguez, Thursday held separate one-on-one meetings with leaders of the Arab American community and committed movement in Metro Detroit, among them Osama Sibani, founder and publisher of the Arab American News, the largest and most widely circulated Arab American publication in the United States. He's based in Dearborn, Michigan, where he joins us from today. Osama Sibani, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about that meeting you had with Julie Chavez Rodriguez, one of the campaign managers for Harris, had been for Biden, the granddaughter of Cesar Chavez? What you had to say to her, and how you feel the Harris Walls campaign is responding to your concerns.
Well, first of all, good morning, Amy, and thank you for having me on your program again. Yes, this is not the first time I met with Julie. Actually, I did meet with her in January of this year when she was managing the campaign of President Biden. And we met in my office for 2.5 hours, and we've had a good discussion, and it was frank. And I met her again last Thursday, and now she's managing the Harris campaign. And we met and we talked for about an hour, and it was a frank and straightforward discussion. It was the same discussion, and I told her that it's true that the Democratic Party changed horses, but we're still seeing the same jockey, that is Benjamin Netanyahu, riding these horses all the way, you know, in the same direction, doing the same thing. You know, I've been listening to the program, and I've listened to the demonstrators, and all of them, they're right on the point. They have made a very good case. I would say that they have represented everything that we believe in, everything that we have said. Between January and between Thursday, we have met several times, senior leaders from the White House, emissaries from the president's office, from the White House, and from the Secretary of State, and nothing has happened. Nothing. Nothing. More killing. Actually, when I met with Julie in January, it was like the killing today, three times as much. So nothing has happened. It's more killing, more destruction, and the genocide is going on without any reprisal, without any kind of, you know, steps to take care from here, from the United States, the most powerful country on the face of this earth, the one that can really stop the killing, not doing anything.
And Osama Sibani, what are the first Biden and now Harris people telling you behind closed doors versus what they're saying to the public?
They are not really saying any much. I mean, they listen to us, they shake their head, and we think that something can happen, and the times go, you know, times passes, and all what we see is more killing. There are no promises. They say that Harris is different. They're from different generations, but we have not seen anything from Harris. We've been listening. We're good listeners, but so far we have not listened to anything that changes policy. She said that she is never going to consider an arms embargo. What about if they kill more people? What are you going to do? You're going to continue to give them more bombs to kill more people? There are no leadership in this country. I am sorry. If they think that they can give us a lip service and then on November 5 go and vote for them because their choices are very bad, the other choice, they are wrong. Because there is another choice that we can sit home. And this is what most of the people are going to be doing, sitting home and not going out to vote. Is that the right thing to do? Of course not. But what choices do we have? You tell me.
So, Osama Sibani, I wanted to ask you about this unprecedented moment where for the first time, the Democratic National Convention today, before the actual convention opens, in one of the side meetings, will be hosting a discussion that includes Leila El-Abed, who is one of the founders of the Uncommitted Movement, the sister of the only Palestinian-American congresswoman, Rashida Tlaib, and others at the McCormick Center around the issue of Palestinian human rights. Do you think that this is an accomplishment?
Well, every time that we stand and speak about the Palestinian issue and the massacres that's happening in Gaza, it is important. And I think that this is an important step. However, what changes this is going to make? We have been talking to this administration since October, right after October. And we have been meeting, and every meeting we listen, they listen, we talk, they listen, they talk, we listen, they leave, nothing happens, more killing is happening. That is what is happening. Now, we have to stop talk. We have to stop the talk and can do something to stop the killing. Because this is what's happening right now. You know, like you see, these people are suffering every day more and more. And we keep talking and nothing is happening. And I don't understand why we're not able to stop it. This country is able to stop the killing tomorrow. If there is a will, there is a way. But the will is not there anymore. So I welcome the discussion. But those discussions are leading us nowhere, Amy. Nowhere. Nowhere. Our people are dying every day in a way that is unprecedented. We see them on television with body parts, their children, carrying children dead, 16, 17 years old, carrying those babies, dripping with blood. That is not a very good scene. That is not how peace is going to be generated in the Middle East. That's more war and more hate, not peace, not harmony anymore. So something has to be done to stop Benjamin Netanyahu's appetite for killing.
I'm wondering if you're heartened, at least in terms of the change in attitude among many Americans. We've seen the votes, the uncommitted votes in the primary, and even here in Illinois, by my calculations, 50,000 people voted in the presidential primary just in Chicago, but did not vote for president because they didn't have an alternative or uncommitted slate here, but their votes were not counted. So there's at least 50,000 people right here in Chicago who opposed President Biden, and about 100,000 in Illinois. Wondering your sense of how the change in public opinion in the United States in terms of Israel's continued occupation of Palestinian land.
I'm very appreciative, in fact, to the to the change in opinion, especially among the young people. And that is due to, being informed through social media, unfortunately, not mainstream media, of what has been happening in Gaza and around the world. And I believe that the change is coming in America. I really do. I mean, I look at the demonstrations and the encampments in the universities, all the universities, especially the Ivy League, and we see those are the potential leaders in America. And I believe that they, in the next maybe decade or two decades, things will change in America. But we have to be patient. We have to be persistent. We have to continue to tell the truth. Once the American people know what is happening, they will make the right decision. That's what happened in 1968. Actually, the history repeats itself when they were demonstrating against the Vietnam War, and people prevailed and they changed, policy. And today, the same thing is happening. America is waking up. The American people are waking up to the fact that there is a crime being committed against civilians in Palestine, and there is a situation there that has been brewing for 76 years, and it is time to end. And therefore, they're going to be aware of it, and they will change it. It's going to take time. Change in America is coming. I believe in the new generation. I believe in what you guys are doing at Democracy Now! And others. And I think that this is changing opinion. And in fact, I see the change coming maybe in the next decade or two decades at most.
Osama Sablani, want to thank you for being with us, founder and publisher of the Arab American News, largest, most widely circulated Arab American publication in the United States, speaking to us from Dearborn, Michigan. Harris's campaign manager, Julie Chavez Rodriguez, met with him for the second time last week. Coming up, we'll speak with two Chicago men who spent decades in prison before being exonerated. Stay with us. All the king's horses, all the king's men, couldn't put our two hearts together again. Mm-hmm.
we sat on the wall of happiness. We sat on the wall of love. We sat on the wall of security, so high above. With his arms all around me, it was like a fairy tale. Two people so in love, tell me how could it fail?
The King's Horses, Aretha Franklin, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency, Breaking with Convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we broadcast from here in Chicago at CAN TV.
Well, we look now at how the city has a long history of police torture under Police Commander John Burge, who is accused of leading a torture ring that interrogated more than 100 African-American men in Chicago in the 1970s and 1980s. They routinely used electric shock and suffocation with plastic bags and typewriter covers, among others, methods to extract confessions from men who were later shown to be innocent. This comes as Illinois has one of the highest rates of wrongful convictions in the United States, and a disproportionate number of the wrongly convicted are black or brown people.
For more, we're joined by two men from right here in Chicago who were exonerated after serving decades in prison. Stanley Howard spent 16 years of his life on death row for a 1984 murder that evidence would later show he did not commit. He says he was tortured until he confessed to the crime. He's the co-founder of the Death Row 10, a group of black men on Illinois' death row who were tortured by the notorious Chicago Police Commander John Burge and his detectives. Howard was pardoned by Governor George Ryan in 2003. He co-authored the book Tortured by Blue, the Chicago Police Torture Story. We're also joined by Jimmy Soto, who was released from an Illinois prison just this past December 14th after a 42-year fight to prove his innocence. At the time of his release, Jimmy Soto was the longest-serving exonerated prisoner in Illinois history. Now he's working on getting a law degree to help others like him. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! It's an honor to have you with us. As you both actually just recently got out, I don't know if people remember what happened in the expose, and he even went to court and was convicted of perjury, lying about the cover-up of torture of black men in Chicago, John Burge. But you were one of those victims. If you can talk about what happened to you and what it meant to serve more than 40 years in prison, Stanley Howard.
Well, what happened to me was a crime. I was tortured on November the 1st, November the 2nd of 1984. When I mean by torture, I was handcuffed with my hands behind my back. And that set of cuffs was cuffed to a ring on the wall. And these three detectives literally beat the heck out of me. When I refused to sign a confession to a crime I did not commit, they suffocated me with a plastic bag and later a typewriter cover. I thought these three white detectives were actually trying to kill me. Mind you, I was 21 years old, scared half to death, and in fear of losing my life inside of this interview room at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. I actually agreed to sign a confession to a crime I did not commit. I later discovered, when evidence started coming out, that I was not the only one. And at that time, I was assured that justice was going to prevail. I did not know that all three branches of government was either complicit in the scandal or work to cover it up or just simply turned a blind eye to what was going on. Maybe because they didn't care. As long as they was attaining convictions, that's all it was about. I ended up on death row, and the courts kept seeing cases after cases after cases of the same officers' names and the same techniques, but they kept denying all of the appeals. So I wanted to take the argument from behind the closed doors of death row, and I wanted to take it to the streets. I wanted the people, if the people was willing to hear our stories and allow the state of Illinois to execute us, so be it. So I started the Death Row 10, and that campaign, we reached out to the campaign to end the death penalty, and they helped us facilitate our public fight, if you will. And based on that, we started getting more movement, especially with Anthony Porter, who was released from death row after spending years and years on death row and was 30-some hours away from being executed. This is the time that we started the Death Row 10, along with the time that Latanya Haggerty, a young girl that was killed by Chicago police because she had a cell phone in her hand.
And you actually, while the time you were in prison, you became a jailhouse lawyer helping so many other inmates. Can you talk about the experiences that you had there helping to mount the legal arguments and the basis for yourself and others eventually being freed?
Well, I had the experience of working with my appellate lawyer, who was horrible. So I started studying criminal law myself. I didn't get any formal education, but I trained, I studied. And I got to the point where I wanted to have a say in my life, my appeals. And I believe I got to the point where I wanted to help other guys on death row also, which is why I started the law class, so-called law class. And based on the law class, we was able to get together, formulate arguments, organize, and push our fight, not just for the death row 10, but to counter the claims of the death penalty here in Illinois. At one point, we had 12, 13 guys executed, but we had 12, 13 guys released from death row. So that tells you something is wrong. And through my advocacy, it wasn't just simply about me. I wanted to help the other guys that I was there with to help save their lives also. Because I believe a government like this government should not be in the business of executing people under any circumstances.
You were on death row for how many years?
16 years.
16 years.
Locked inside of a cell 23, 24 hours a day, every day. Torture. So I was tortured by cops. Then I was tortured by the state of Illinois.
And now you are free. Former Republican Governor George Ryan, Governor of Illinois, commuted 167 prisoners on death row to life in prison. And then you have before that, after that, in 2011, Democratic Governor Pat Quinn signed legislation that made Illinois the 16th state to abolish the death penalty. Jimmy Soto, I want to turn to you. Congratulations on being out, but the horror that you were in for over 40 years, the longest held prisoner, exonerated prisoner in this country. Tell us your story.
Well, you know, it happened in 1981 on the southwest side of Chicago in an area called Little Village. A tragic shooting occurred, and I gave it no thought that it would ever come on my doorstep. Unfortunately, the police, as Stanley was pointing out, in that time period, used tactics in which they wanted to just close a case. And so being pressured by those in authority in the city of Chicago, they set out to try to just solve the case in a way that skirted any legal methods that they should have done. They rounded up approximately 25 people from that area, 20 of which were under the age of 17. So just think of that. These are juveniles. Held them for 3 days, and got them to make false statements on me. They took them to the grand jury, and they put the case on me. There was no evidence, physical, forensic, no eyewitnesses. They managed to get one individual to stand up and be what they say, quote unquote, an accomplice witness. And at years of fighting, like Stan Lee, I was self-taught prison litigator. Over the course of that time, I managed to get two people fully exonerated, and I was able to get over 300 sentence reductions and 14 new trials. But, you know, the actual fight was to get me out. And eventually that happened. It wasn't easy. It wasn't an easy task. And I never want to see anybody go through that. Unfortunately, like as you indicated, Juan, at the beginning of the show, that Illinois has some of the highest numbers of exonerations. I went to an exoneration conference in Louisiana shortly after I was released. And by far, Illinois, in just a year, 1 year, exceeded any other state for exonerations. And when I looked at the whole room and seen those thousands of people that have been exonerated over the years, it's a clear red flag that there's something seriously wrong with our criminal justice system.
And also, Illinois is a state that does not have parole for folks who are in prison. Can you talk about that and the and what that does in terms of people staying in longer?
Yes. As I was sentenced to natural life without parole, which is a slow death by incarceration. And during that time in there, we started, I was going to school. I went to the Northwestern Prison Education Program, but I also joined PNAP, the Prison Neighborhood Arts Project. And there was a think tank. And in that think tank, individuals said, hey, there is no parole in Illinois. We need to do something about it. And right there, there was a effort birth, which we wanted to have paroleillinois.org. And we formed a nonprofit organization to bring back parole. There's been no parole in Illinois since 1978. And there's a lot of people who have, quote unquote, been rehabilitated, yet they linger for decades in the most horrible conditions. Because it's not only the fact that I did 42 years, 2 months, 2 days, it's the conditions in which I did it. As Stanley indicated, it is really slow torture every day.
And you mentioned also the discussions we had yesterday that you also were organizing within the prison in terms of the Latino prisoners. You, for a while, you spent time with some of the FALN pro-independence folks that were in prison as well.
That's correct. You know, Luis Rosa in particular, as I said, there was programs giving you higher education, but they had nothing to show to give us an education about our history, Latinos. And so we decided to formulate the Latino Cultural Exchange Committee, which was an independent program, which we now start to bring in the history of Puerto Rico, Mexico, Central America, South America, and bringing it to those and to awaken within them some dignity and some pride in their heritage.
Can you talk about the case of 51-year-old Michael Broadway, who died just this past June in Stateville Prison? Just the year before he was one of your classmates who were among the first group of incarcerated men to receive a bachelor's degree from a top 10 university, Northwestern.
Yeah, well, Michael was not only a cohort, but a friend. And when I learned about his death in June, it really hit me hard because it shouldn't have happened. The conditions there were inhabitable. An independent engineering report that the IDOC was aware of said that six of the prisons in Illinois were not fit to have human beings in there. And so Michael was in one of those prisons, Stateville. He was on one of the highest galleries, and it was very warm. It was hot. It was over 100 degrees, no circulation, window sealed shut. Michael had an asthma attack and unfortunately died. And when I learned that that happened, I held a town hall meeting here in Chicago, and there was another organization was born. A movement was birthed. In that, I said, I'm going to do something about this and bring awareness of what's going on. And I call it building communities, not prisons, to not let Michael's death be in vain. And so we pushed really hard to get Stateville closed. And I'm glad to say that finally a federal court judge ordered Stateville closed by September 30th. But it doesn't end there. The women in Logan are also subjected to horrible conditions, and we're pushing to get that closed and all of those prisons closed. The IDOC is operating at only 60%. That means they got 40% room, but yet they want to knock down Stateville and Logan and rebuild new prison at a cost of $900 million. And my question is, why can't we take that $900 million and put it at the front end to prevent people coming to prison as opposed to investing in the future that we're saying we're going to continue this nightmare of mass incarceration?
And when you talk about conditions, could you talk about what those conditions are? Even the water supply in many of these prisons is toxic?
Yes. It's been really noted that they know that these antiquated prisons, for one, the plumbing, the piping, it's got lead pipes, so that means the lead's going to be in water. But even the sources like the aquifers that are there in Will County, in Joliet, the sources where they get the water that is ran to the prison, it also has heavy metals, other toxins which is in the water, which is causing it. I personally had my blood tested, and I had elevated levels of lead caused by the drinking that water in Stateville.
So you've been invited to the Democratic National Convention Tuesday night?
Yes, by a group called FWD.us. And I'm going to go there and meet some people. And they are a group who wants to show that how immigration right now, which is a hot topic issue, and carceral systems are intertwined. You know, because now they want to criminalize. They want to criminalize black and brown bodies, and this is a way to further criminalize through saying these migrants that are coming in are, quote-unquote, bad hombres, bad people.
And Stanley, I wanted to ask you, Democratic National Convention is about to nominate a former prosecutor, Kamala Harris, as the Democratic candidate for president. Your sense of the continued emphasis, even among the Democrats, on punishment and incarceration as a means of dealing with crime?
Well, I'd like to also say that the mental health service inside of prison is terrible. The health care is terrible, and all the buildings are crazy. I did a protest out in front of Cook County Jail a couple of weeks ago, and I looked at this building where the prosecutor's office was at. Mind you, if when you say that Cook County is the wrongful conviction capital of the world, somebody had to be involved in that. It was the prosecutors. They all got away with it. And still getting away with it. Kamala Harris, I do not know much about her history as a prosecutor, but knowing that there's a prosecutor at the helm of our government, and she's going to reach back and tell these prosecutors that their number one job is to seek justice and not convictions, I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. I have many questions for her about her life as a prosecutor, but I also would like to know what she's going to do to reform this system from the time when they used to call, quote unquote, the war on drugs, the war on crime, and just get tough on crime, to where, as we know, the crime has continued to fall, and all these dramatic rulings and bills that they put in place, what about rolling those back now? What is she going to do for that effort? And that's why I'm here now. Since I've been out, I'm working at Uptown People's Law Center, who does great work for those on the inside. And I received telephone calls from family members. I answered the guys on the inside's mail also. And to know that prosecutors are at the helm of this mass incarceration. Jimmy said there was thousands of people that was wrongfully convicted at this conviction that he was at. Prosecutors prosecuted their cases. And like I said in my book, Tortured by Blue, the problem with prosecutors is that it takes a prosecutor to prosecute a prosecutor, but prosecutors are not in the business of prosecuting prosecutors.
Yeah. 24 states allow the death penalty. 23 states have abolished capital punishment altogether. 3 states, California, Oregon, and Pennsylvania, have governor-issued moratoriums in place, halting executions in the state. We're almost at the point where more than half of the states in this country will abolish the death penalty. And then the argument will be, overall in terms of getting rid of it, that it is cruel and unusual punishment. The U.S. is very rare in the industrialized world in continuing with the death penalty. Your thoughts on this, Stanley, as a man who might have been executed if it weren't for your activism and your community that fought for you until ultimately you were exonerated?
Well, it's kind of ironic that the Conservative Party is for life on the front end, but they are for death on the back end. I do not understand that philosophy. But we have a guy by the name of Mary Hooper who was transferred from Illinois' death row to Arizona. It's amazing that half of Arizonans do not trust their government, so much so they don't even trust the election. But he was executed last year. So the government is in the business of executing people, but can't get their elections right. I believe that a country that executes its citizens really do not have the moral compass to tell another country nowhere around this planet what to do. It was once said that if you want to know what is going on in the country, all you have to do is look inside the prisons and look inside the death row. And we have to end this death penalty in this country. And we have to end life without the possibility of parole also.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. It has been so important. Do you think, when it comes to the Democratic and Republican leaders of this country, that it makes a difference who is in power?
Absolutely.
I'll end with you, Jimmy.
Absolutely it does. I mean, we have to get a Democrat in there. Kamala may not be the best candidate, but we need to get out there and vote, because the only other alternative is Trump. And I think Trump will turn this country upside down to where we're going to probably go back 10, 15 years of progress that we made, because not only economically, but even within our carceral system. There needs to be a change. It needs to be a change now.
Well, I want to thank you both again. Jimmy Soto, longest serving exonerated prisoner in Illinois history. Since his release in December, he's been working on going to law school, getting a law degree to help others like him. And Stanley Howard, co-founder of Death Row 10, spent 16 years of his life on death row for a 1984 murder that evidence would later show he did not commit.
And in breaking news, the pioneering TV host Phil Donahue has died at the age of 88. The Phil Donahue Show, later renamed Donahue, ran from the 1960s through to 1996 and tackled major social and political issues, including women's rights, child abuse in the Catholic Church, and prisons, and racism. Among his notable interview subjects was Nelson Mandela, whom he spoke with shortly after his release from a South African prison in 1990. Over his career, Donahue won 20 Emmy Awards and received the Peabody Award.
In 2003, Phil Donahue was fired from his primetime MSNBC talk show during the run-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It was the most popular talk show on MSNBC at the time. The problem wasn't Phil's ratings, but rather his views. An internal MSNBC memo warned Donahue was a, quote, difficult public face for NBC in a time of war, providing a, quote, home for the liberal anti-war agenda at the same time that our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity, unquote. In 2013, we spoke to Phil Donahue about his firing.
I think what happened to me, the biggest lesson, I think, is the how corporate media shapes our opinions and our coverage. This was the decision to release me, came from far above. This was not an assistant program director who decided to separate me from MSNBC. They were terrified of the anti-war voice, and that is not an overstatement. Anti-war voices were not popular. And if you're General Electric, you certainly don't want an anti-war voice on a cable channel that you own. Donald Rumsfeld's your biggest customer. So, by the way, I had to have two conservatives on for every liberal. I could have Richard Perle on alone, but I couldn't have Dennis Kucinich on alone. I was considered two liberals. It really is funny almost when you look back on how the management was just frozen by the anti-war voice. We were scolds. We weren't patriotic. American people disagreed with us, and we weren't good for business.
That was the groundbreaking TV host and journalist Phil Donahue. Following his firing, Phil went on to co-direct the documentary Body of War that told the story of the U.S. Iraq War veteran Thomas Young, who was paralyzed after being shot in Iraq and came home to become an anti-war activist. Phil Donahue died on Sunday at the age of 88. He survived by his wife, Marlo Thomas, his four children, and his grandchildren. Our condolences to the whole Thomas Donahue family. Phil Donahue, the pioneering TV talk show host. That does it for our show. We just have less than a minute to go. Tune in to our expanded daily two-hour broadcast from Chicago, from the Democratic National Convention, inside and out, from the streets to the suites to the convention floor. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable group of people: Mike Burke, Shrutha Gokhadoos, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresa Sana, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, and Anna Elias. Our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, and right here to CAN TV. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're in Chicago.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.